Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist program that Angela Walker and I ran on in 2020. And there's a lot to talk about this week. We got Supreme Court decisions. I'll give you a report on my conversation with Cornel West a few days ago. And then talk about the aftermath of the Wagner mutiny, not that we know much, and then the crisis with the Zaporizhia nuclear complex. And, you know, it's time to get the UN involved, seriously. So, but let's start with these Supreme Court decisions. Most of them were very negative for democracy and progressive values, but let's start with the one somewhat positive decision, and that was the Supreme Court rejected the so-called independent legislator theory, which would have given state legislatures wide authority to gerrymander electoral maps, pass voter suppression laws, and actually overturn elections, including sending electors to the Electoral College in presidential elections who don't represent the candidate that won the popular vote in those states. And this was based on a fringe legal theory of the hard right that state legislatures can do whatever they want, no matter what state constitutions, the courts, legislatures, governors, election administrators, independent redistricting commissions, or the voters say. It was a wild theory, and it was a brazen attempt by hard right Republicans in the state legislatures they control, about 20 of them. They control totally with the governorship, basically to seize and maintain power no matter what the people really want. And that seems to have been too far even for the far right elitists in the Supreme Court, who are no fans of democracy. They kind of believe an elite should rule, and democracy is kind of a burden. But so it's good they rejected it, although some pro-democracy lawyers warn that this decision gives more power to the Supreme Court to decide election disputes in the states, which is problematic given the hard right composition of this court. So that's the good news. We had a number of decisions, one of them on affirmative action, which basically nationalized the California ban on race-based affirmative action that passed by referendum in 1996. And has been a disaster for Black, Latino, and Indigenous admissions to California public universities, particularly the more selective University of California campuses. So since that passed, Black and Indigenous enrollment has been cut in half. Latino enrollment is maintained, but it's been shifted to the less selective state colleges as opposed to the more selective University of California campuses. And for Latinos, the gap between the number of high school graduates and enrollment in the University of California campuses is highest of any ethnic group by far. And conservatives tried to use Asian plaintiffs to pit Asians and whites against Black, Latino, and Indigenous people. Very divisive. But the reality is Asian support for affirmative action is higher than it is for white and Latinos. It trails Black support by just 8%. Asian support is 53%, Black support 61%. Latino support is only 36%, which is 17% less than for Asians. And white support is only 31%, which is 23% less than for Asians. So the idea that Asians are going after Black, Latino, and Indigenous people to their own advantage just doesn't hold for the majority of Asians in this country. And of course, affirmative action is a range of programs that are designed to increase the admission of underrepresented groups among applicants who are qualified, and programs to help more members of those groups become qualified. It's never been about quotas for admitting members of underrepresented groups, even if they're not qualified, although that's the way it's presented by the opponents of affirmative action. Now, this decision affects elite colleges that are selective. Most colleges accept everybody who's qualified these days. So this is really about the gateway to the upper middle and upper layers of society. And I'm going to read from Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's decision, which I said in a tweet. The common sense and morality of her decision dwarfs that of the six conservative bird-brained ostriches, the conservatives, in their opinions, explaining their decision to end affirmative action in college admissions. So Ketanji Brown Jackson says, with let them eat cake obliviousness today, the majority pulls the ripcord and announces colorblindness for all by legal fiat, but deeming race irrelevant in law does not make it so in life. And having so detached itself from this country's actual past and present experiences, the court has now been lured into interfering with the crucial work that the University of North Carolina and other institutions of higher learning are doing to solve America's real-world problems. No one benefits from ignorance. Although formal race-linked legal barriers are gone, race still matters to the lived experiences of all Americans in innumerable ways. And today's ruling makes that worse, not better. The best that can be said of the majority's perspective is that it proceeds ostrich-like from the hope that preventing consideration of race will end racism. But if that is its motivation, the majority proceeds in vain. If the colleges of this country are required to ignore a thing that matters, it will just not go away. It will take longer for racism to leave us. And ultimately, ignoring race just makes it matter more. And so I think, you know, she just destroyed the majority's opinion. Now, Justice Roberts, who wrote it, the Chief Justice, did leave a crack in the door, saying that applicants' race can be considered on an individual basis. Quote, nothing in this opinion should be construed as prohibiting universities from considering an applicant's discussion of how race affected his or her life, be it through discrimination, inspiration, or otherwise. So what the Roberts majority opinion really says is that colleges cannot pursue racial balance for its educational benefits for all students, but it can consider the effect race has had on individual applicants. But, you know, the hard right justices, hypocrites that they are, made an exception. And they said the military academies, which are very selective, are still allowed to pursue racial balance in incoming classes. And as Jackson, Justice Jackson noted, these hypocrites only want to prepare underrepresented minorities for success in the bunker, not the boardroom. Now, some have tried to, you know, put a good light on this decision where Justice Roberts left the door open. Matt Brunick at the People's Policy Project, he was a policy advisor to Bernie Sanders. He helped me out a little bit in 2020. He said, quote, the court has created new rules about how race can be considered in admissions. Under the old rules, race could be considered in service of the goal of creating a racially diverse student body in order to promote better education through exposure to different kinds of people. Under the new rules, race can be considered in the context of how it affected a particular applicant's life and how those effects reflect the person's character and unique abilities. So that does give colleges more leeway than just deciding solely based on, you know, so-called neutral merit standards like standardized tests, which are anything but neutral and more reflect what where people are at, not where they can get at. And but it also puts the burden on applicants to present how their racial background and experience means they merit admissions. And the burden is on colleges to let applicants know that this is relevant to their applications. So what that means, I think, for us is that the admissions process remains contested. And those of us with connections to colleges with selective admissions are going to have to fight for procedures that keep the doors open for the racially oppressed. And so if California is any precedent, this is not good, but the fight is not over to keep the doors open at the selective colleges and universities. And then another decision was on student debt. And, you know, the cost of college is probably even a bigger deterrent to students from disadvantaged backgrounds than the admissions process, and really for anybody from low to middle income backgrounds. And what the court did was strike down the Biden administration's plan to cancel $430 billion in student loan debt, which would have benefited 43 million Americans. The plan was to cancel up to $10,000 in debt for everyone making less than $125,000 a year. Student debt, by some estimates, is as high as $1.8 trillion. By all estimates, that's second only to home mortgage debt. It's a huge drag on the economy and on the lives of former students who delay major life decisions like marriage and having children and buying homes because they have these debts. And what the Supremes did in this decision was invoke the so-called major questions doctrine, which they claim gives them the right to interfere in presidential policy that was not expressly given to them by Congress. Of course, most laws in Congress, you know, give a general direction and policy and then ask the administrative, the executive branch, to write the regulations, procedures, and programs to implement that broader law. And now the Supreme Court is saying, no, Congress has got to say down to details what the executive branch can do. And Elena Kagan's dissent on this, I think, you know, she was right. She derided this doctrine, this major questions doctrine, as quote unquote made up. You know, what she said is the Supreme Court is substituting itself for the elected branches of government, Congress and the president. And these are the supposed strict constructionists who are conservative justices. They're really radical justices. They're legislating. Now, Biden still has other authorities he can use to cancel student debt. And if he does it, they'll probably go back to court, but it's better that he do that than surrender in the fight for student debt relief. And then we get to LGBTQ discrimination. And this court in a decision called the Act of Discrimination, Freedom of Religion and Free Speech. So it makes you wonder what's next. Racial housing discrimination is freedom of religion and free speech. And then you have to wonder how this plaintiff even had standing. You know, the plaintiff who won, she never opened her business. And what she was saying is it's a website business and she didn't want to design websites for gay couples. I mean, these bird brain conservative justices really can't think straight. And this is just a terrible decision that blows a big hole in anti-discrimination law at the federal level across the board. So, you know, the Supreme Court is a huge problem. The Democrats should have expanded it when they had the chance, when they had majorities in both houses. The GOP stole two seats. They denied Garland a hearing for almost a year. He was a Obama appointee, and that was at the end of Obama's term, but he was appointed early in the last year. And then Amy Coney Barrett, to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, was late in the year. And McConnell just pushed that through at record pace during the 2020 presidential election. So obvious contradiction and hypocrisy there. So the justices got two more, or the Supreme Court got two more right-wing justices, the last two that were appointed. And five of these six hard right justices were appointed by presidents who lost the popular vote, George W. Bush and Donald Trump. And when you think about it, Republicans have lost the national popular vote. I mean, they've won the national popular vote only once since 1988. That was 2004 when the Iraq War was going on and people rallied around Bush. But even though they've won only once since 1988, they've appointed 16 of the last 20 justices, two of whom, two recent ones, have been credibly accused of sexual assault. And all six of these conservatives were confirmed by a Supreme Court, I mean, by a US Senate, that structurally overweights the interests of smaller, whiter states and is therefore regularly controlled by the Republican Party through the Senate Republicans, who have not won more votes or represented more Americans than Democrats since the 1990s. In other words, you look at the total vote for Democrats and Republicans for Senate across the country, Democrats always win, but the Republicans control the Senate most of the time. So I would argue the Democrats have every right to expand the court and pack it with some new appointees to balance it out a little bit. Biden doesn't want to do that. Another good reform would be term limits of 18 years. And as you staggered those in, it would mean each president would get two appointments per four-year term. Under normal circumstances, they'd get an additional one if a justice died or retired early. But that would sort of remove the incentive and the ability for people like McConnell and the Republicans to play the games they did with the last two appointments. So, you know, the Supreme Court is a real anti-democratic institution in our government. And it's just disappointing and frustrating that the Democrats really don't have a program for dealing with it. They're not going to expand the court. They're not talking about term limits. They're not talking about Supreme Court reform at all. And, you know, basically with the court we got now and the way it's structured, I mean, we're looking at decades of these far right Republicans running the Supreme Court. Something has to be done. So next thing is, on Wednesday night, I had a good conversation with Cornel West for about 90 minutes. And mainly I gave him suggestions for campaign organization and his policy platform. And the campaign organization stuff is, you know, just sharing my experiences and giving him some things to think about and look for. When it came to policy, I think it's good. He told me that the concerns a lot of people had in the democracy section of his platform that he first came out with term limits for Congress and hand counting of ballots, which is kind of a big thing for the election denial crowd. He said, you know, he got that from the People's Party at the beginning, and those are going to be out. And I think he will be a champion for the game-changing reforms of ranked choice voting and proportional representation, as well as really beat up Biden and the Democrats for failing to pass the voting rights and election protection legislation the Democrats failed to pass when they had majorities in both houses and could have repealed or at least carved out for these bills the filibuster. And, you know, that's a real, I think, important issue to, you know, it's a real contrast between his campaign and Biden's. Now on Ukraine, you know, I know Cornell and his history on international questions. I think he wants to take an independent internationalist position. And you can see that when he calls Putin a gangster and Russia an empire. And he also criticizes US-led Western imperialism and NATO's expansion. But so far, he's been coming out for actually Russia's top two demands: cut the arms to Ukraine and have an immediate ceasefire in negotiations. And now what he said was, well, what he would like to see negotiations do is get Russia to withdraw from all the Ukrainian territories in return for mutual security arrangements among Russia, Ukraine, and the NATO nations. And, you know, that's basically Ukraine's position, the 10-point proposal that Zelensky's been touting for the last 9 months. Now, of course, Russia says, yeah, we'll have a ceasefire and negotiations, but the occupied territories are non-negotiable. That's where the impasse is. So, you know, we kicked those things around for a while. And where we left it was, I'm going to arrange a briefing for him with Ukrainian socialists from Soltsiyonny Rukh, the social movement in Ukraine, the Democratic Socialist Organization there. And what I, you know, pitched to him was, you know, if you're going to be talking about the least of these, which is his theme, he wants to be their advocate. When it comes to Ukraine, the least of these are the victims of Russia's invasion and occupation and the war crimes they're suffering. So, you know, at this point, I'm going to support Cornell, somewhat critically, perhaps, depending on his Ukraine policy and maybe other things. But I'm not going to make Ukraine or anything else a litmus test like some are making for me demanding that I resign or be expelled because I support Ukraine's struggle for national liberation and their right to secure arms from wherever they can get them. People may disagree with that, but does that mean I should be expelled? Or does that mean we should continue to debate and try to build consensus on policy and more understanding? And that is where I think the political culture of the Green Party needs to be going toward. We need a stronger emphasis on education and constructive debate. Too much of the debate, and if you're on a national committee list, it comes down to name calling and gotcha, and it's not very healthy. And actually, that's how I conclude. I did an article for Against the Current, which came out today. It's called The Green Party Debate on Ukraine. And we're going to put that in the chat so you can check that out. But, after going over the debate and the back and forth, I said, my conclusion was probably the most important thing to do is work on our political culture and our education. Because one thing I found in that debate is lots of people don't really know much about Ukraine. They're kind of relying on their usual sources and who they trust rather than, getting down to the real facts, which is a problem because if you have a one-size-fits-all solution like U.S. imperialism, whatever the U.S. does, we have to oppose, even though it might be doing the right thing in certain circumstances, U.S. military. You can't answer that question without looking at the actual facts on the ground. And so I think, education needs to be at a premium. I also have an article that will be coming out any day called Pricey Propaganda Against Ukraine Solidarity that will be posted in Tempest magazine. And it's about how groups on the authoritarian left and some pacifist groups are spending millions of dollars against Ukraine solidarity. And I argue that their neutrality between Russian imperialism and Ukraine's resistance is morally bankrupt. I mean, you just can't sit on the sidelines in that kind of struggle. And their call for the U.S. to cut a land for peace deal with Russia and force it on the Ukrainians is imperial arrogance. That is U.S. imperialism trying to impose a solution over the heads of the Ukrainians. So you can, check that out and see what I said there. And I also have another article coming out in the July issue of Ralph Nader's Capitol Hill Citizen called Questions for Cornel West, which Ralph and Russell Mokhiber, who work on that, solicited. And, it asks questions he needs to answer for his campaign about his organization. Is he going to carry through an independent Green campaign through the November election, his pro-democracy platform in Ukraine? And the tone of the article is of hope. It is hopeful that he will have good answers. And after our discussion on Wednesday, I think he will, for the most part. I mean, we still got to talk some more about Ukraine, I think. But that is a report on that discussion. And, the next step is I'm going to try to set up this Zoom call with some Ukrainian lefties about, what they are asking for in terms of solidarity. And when we were meeting last week, this Wagner mutiny was going on. And just before I came on the podcast, we got the report that Prigozhin had called off the march on Moscow, but it was still unclear what was going on. And it's still unclear what's going on. Where is Prigozhin? He hasn't been seen since he left Rostov-on-Don. That was almost a week ago now. Where is General Gerasimov, who was the commander of the forces in Ukraine? He's not been seen. And then there's General Surikovin, who is the Air Force general, who is known infamously for the bombing of Syria, and was seen a similar campaign against Ukraine, but he showed up on a. Looked like a hostage video. He had an automatic pistol, in his right hand, and he said, Prigozhin should call it off. But the Russians suspect he may have been in on it, knew about it, and didn't inform them. So, there's a question, is a purge going on in the Russian military and security services? We know that Wagner commanders in Syria have at least reportedly been detained by Russian and Syrian secret services. And, what was Prigozhin's motives? We had reports that the Russian military wanted to, have all his fighters sign with the Russian military, which would just take the Wagner organization away from him. We now have reports that the Russian military is going to take over the imperialist operations in Africa, in Mali, Central African Republic, Sudan, Burkina Faso, Libya. It's about oil, gas, gold, and diamond concessions in payment for providing security for dictators and warlords in those countries. And it's kind of been a one step removed Russian imperialism to Wagner. Now it may just be the Russian armed forces. So that's something to keep an eye on that. My take at this point is this was a fight between gangsters and we had no dog in it. The Russian people were mostly passive. They intimidated by repression and confused and maybe now entertained by the competing propaganda from the Telegram channels from Prigozhin and some of these military bloggers and state media, which were putting out different messages. So maybe Putin and his allies, want to take over what Wagner was doing in Africa and in the contracts for Syria that Wagner had. We just have to keep watching this and see how it plays out. Although Putin seems to have the upper hand in this confrontation, his image of strength and competency seemed weakened in the eyes of Russians in the world. I mean, his sort of social contract with the Russians is you stay out of politics and I'll deliver a better material standard of living. And that seems to have broken down somewhat with this war. But for us as internationalists, I think, we should continue to demand that Russian troops get out of Ukraine and support Ukraine's civil and armed resistance to this imperialist invasion and occupation. And we should also be giving platforms to the anti-war left opposition of Russia, both those inside and many who have now gone into exile outside of Russia, and support those exiles, immigration rights, along with all immigrants. I mean, that's a whole nother big problem. And then support the Russian political prisoners, of which there are many. Some we hear about, like Navalny and Gara-Murza, I got his name right, who are liberals, but there are many radical anti-war and socialist political prisoners. Basically, anybody who speaks out against the war, even indirectly, can be in trouble and are being sent away to prison terms. And they need our support so they can, survive this imprisonment and come out the other end when the opportunity presents itself. And then the last thing, I think, and I've been going almost half an hour, we got a real serious crisis with the Zaporizhia nuclear complex. Russia is pulling out its military personnel and employees, and they're supposed to be out by July 5th. That's next Wednesday. And the Russians are telling the personnel that remain, if anything happens, blame Ukraine. And Ukraine, of course, has been saying that the Russians have mined the Zaporizhia nukes and may blow them up to create a nuclear catastrophe. So, my question is, where the hell is the international community? The International Atomic Energy Agency has been in there. They've been pleading, but they've not been forceful. And I don't know quite why that is. One problem may be politics. The second in leadership at that agency is a Russian, Alexander Bychkov, who's been the deputy director and head of its nuclear energy department since 2011. In any case, the Ukrainian historian, socialist, and now soldier Taras Bilis has an article out, and he's been a prolific commentator on this Russian-Ukrainian war. You should read his stuff. I don't know how he does it, given that he's in the armed forces at this point, but he is. And he has an article out in Commons, which is the left-wing publication. It also appeared in Open Democracy, a left-wing publication in Ukraine, calling on the UN General Assembly to authorize a peacekeeping force to take over administration and protection of the Zaporizhia nuclear power complex. And he has a discussion in there of why the politics might be, the politics now may enable that to happen. with, you know, Russia deciding to go along. And you can read that for yourself, but I think this is a demand we should be raising right now, because, you know, before some of those six reactors, it's the largest nuclear complex in Europe, much larger than Chernobyl was, before some or all of them melt down due to a lack of water for the cooling systems, since the Kakhovka Dam was blown up a couple of weeks ago, or due to sabotage, you know, from mines or whatever. So we're going to put that article in the chat. Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, UN needs to avoid catastrophe in Ukraine. And it's interesting, you know, the Security Council is not going to do anything because Russia has a veto, but the UN General Assembly does have the power to authorize peacekeeping. They last did it during the Suez Canal crisis in 1956. And that power that they have has atrophied since, but maybe it's now time to step up, because, you know, we could be on the edge of a real environmental catastrophe. So I hope that wasn't too long, but there was a lot to cover this week, and I'm looking forward to your questions and comments. Scout Trooper 164, if Russia blows up the nuclear plant, this could go badly. Not only could Turkey get affected, but the wind patterns could direct radiation to Russian land, major backfire. Yeah, that's true. If Russia was going to do it, they'd probably look at the, you know, weather projections and try to do it at a time when the wind wasn't blowing back into Russia. But, you know, it would be a major crime against humanity if they did that. And, you know, in the fog of war, it's hard to know. Russia claims that, you know, Ukraine's going to do it as a false flag operation. I think Russia's just talking. I think, you know, and maybe Ukraine's just talking and the nuke isn't mined to be blown up. But they still face that water cooling problem. They have enough water for about a month from when the dam blew. But, you know, I've seen aerial photos on some of these Telegram channels. You know, the water is not flowing into the, you know, basically artificial lake or pond they set up to have water for cooling the reactors. So, you know, it's a serious situation. And, you know, I'm not hearing a big clamor for the UN General Assembly to, you know, step into the breach here, but it's time that they did. Frankie Lee, Howie, if the Russians left Ukraine, wouldn't the Azov types in the West just go back to massacring the ethnic Russians in the Southeast? Well, Putin claims they were being massacred. They weren't. There was some protests when the Revolution of Dignity, the Maidan Revolution, happened in 2014. But the secret security people from Russia, Prigozhin among them, this guy named, his name of war is Strelkov. His real name is Igor something. Anyway, you know, they have bragged that there would have been no armed rebellion. You know, Strelkov talks about putting the Crimean parliament back in session at gunpoint so they would vote to have a referendum, which took place like 10 days later. You know, hardly a fair referendum, and the choices really didn't give people the choice to stay in Ukraine. And then in, you know, Donetsk and Luhansk, you know, Strelkov says, you know, there was no separatist movement ready to fight, you know, for independence. It was, you know, his, paramilitary that he, and he's a, you know, he comes out of military intelligence and the FSB, you know, the security service in Russia. They were the ones who went in there. So that was their excuse. And Russia had, you know, tried to foment separatist groups since after the Orange Revolution in 2004. And they were just seen as a far-right fringe in the Donbass. If the Russians left Ukraine, you know, what most people say, and I think the Ukrainians are willing to have this, is we should have a UN peacekeeping force in there to allow people who fled the Donbass and Crimea when the Russians had their little coups, to come back and then have some kind of, you know, referendum to decide the status of these areas under UN supervision instead of these phony referenda that Russia set up for now five oblasts. It's like their states. So no, I think, you know, the concern would be, you know, people are in a hard place if they're in occupied territory. The Russians say you got to take a Russian passport. And if a Ukrainian says, no, I want to keep my Ukrainian passport, now they're suspect. They can be detained. Some are tortured. Some women are raped. Some men are castrated. Some are deported to Russia, including tens of thousands of children. So if you're one of those Ukrainians and you say, well, I'm going to take a Russian passport just to protect myself, and then the Ukrainians come back and they say, why do you have a Russian passport? You got to have a process where, you know, those kinds of things can be adjudicated. And that's why, you know, a lot of people say, you know, a peace settlement should provide for UN peacekeepers going in there and making sure that people's human rights and due process are protected. But there's not going to be a massacre. There wasn't one before. Lomboy Wilson, nothing is solely anything, but the Russians would not have invaded had Zelensky pledged neutrality. They had a peace agreement that is more favorable than anything that will come. NATO squashed it. Well, I think you're absolutely wrong about that. Zelensky did pledge neutrality in the agreement that was on the table at the end of March 2022. Zelensky would be, or Ukraine would be neutral. It would have security guarantees signed by Russia, China, US, UK, the big powers. They would not have nuclear weapons, which is already in their constitution. They would not have foreign troops on their territory, which is already in Ukraine's constitution. And then the status of the disputed areas at that time, part of Donbass and Crimea, would be determined diplomatically, not militarily. In other words, probably by a UN-supervised referenda. And Ukraine was for that. So on April 7th, Lavrov announced that the plan is unacceptable. They want more. They want more territory. On April 9th, Boris Johnson showed up. And that's where we get these reports that he told Zelensky that the West would not support him in negotiations. Now, there are two Ukrainian socialists who actually talked to the author of that article. It's the only source of that report. It's an anonymous source inside the Ukrainian government. And the author of that article said, no, his reporting is not that Johnson said you can't sign or you can't negotiate. It was a warning, you can't trust Putin. And the Ukrainians already know that. So that was on April 9th. I think I got my dates right. It was that kind of spacing. And then 3 days later, Putin said the negotiations were at a dead end. And throughout that spring, Zelensky said he was still willing to negotiate, although public opinion in Ukraine swinged hard against negotiating with Putin after the massacre at Bucha and Izium and these other places were revealed. And so the public opinion polling in Ukraine from the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology shows Ukrainians are overwhelmingly opposed to a land for peace deal with Russia. They don't want to give up occupied territory, and particularly people, their family and friends and compatriots, to the brutal occupation by Russia. So what Zelensky's been proposing since his 10-point plan came out in the fall is he's willing to have a ceasefire to negotiate the peaceful withdrawal of the Russians. That's the core of his proposal. Putin has said he's ready for a ceasefire, but the occupied territories are non-negotiable. So that's where the impasse is. Now there's talk that the CIA director Burns was with Zelensky, and they're talking about pushing a ceasefire and peace proposal toward the end of the year after this counteroffensive hopefully gains more land for Ukraine. We'll see what comes of that. But I just want to say that, you know, it was not the West or Ukraine that said we're not going to negotiate. And they didn't reject that peace agreement. It was the Russians that did. And that was at a time when the Russians had their maximum advance, you know, toward the end of March. Since then, the Ukrainians have reclaimed half the land that the Russians occupied at one point. So that's where it stands. But the impasse is, yeah, Ukraine will have a ceasefire to, you know, negotiate how to have a peaceful withdrawal of the Russians. And the Russians are saying, we'll have a ceasefire as long as it gives us the land we're occupying. So that's where they're stuck. Lively Fern 59. Are there any clauses that can cause Cornel West to not run if the Green Party nomination fails? Don't see why it wouldn't. Yeah, there are no candidates that have stepped up that are actually building a campaign organization and raising money. I mean, we often have, you know, people just say, I'm running for president, and they really don't do anything. So I would say at this point, you know, Cornel doesn't have any competition. Different than me in 2020, there was, you know, Daryl Hunter, and he had a lot of support in the institutions of the Green Party and people saying the elections, the primaries were rigged. Actually, three of them are rigged against me, but that's a whole nother story. I don't think Cornell's going to have those obstacles. I think for the most part, people in the party are getting behind him, although they have questions like, you know, I talked about earlier, but I think he's going to answer them well. So there are no, you know, clauses in the, you know, Green Party rules or anything that can prevent Cornell from getting the nomination. He just has to, you know, go out and talk to people, give them the respect of his attention. And I think, you know, he will win, you know, the conventions and the primaries and come to the convention with the delegates. Unless somebody else pops up that's, you know, got his kind of celebrity or organization to, you know, make it a competitive race. I just don't see that. So, you know, my attitude at this point is, you know, let's work with Cornell and make it, you know, make the best of it. Yeah, I noticed in the chat that Steve Welzer references an article that Mike Feinstein wrote in the LA Progressive. Yeah, there's the note. And this is about the democracy question. And I think, you know, Mike raises criticism of, you know, term limits and hand counts and goes into the things that Cornell should be talking about, particularly ranked choice voting and proportional representation. And I think, you know, that's where Cornell is headed. So, but anyway, you can Google LA Progressive Mike Feinstein and probably get that article. It came out a day or two ago. So back to that other question. Amy L. Sachs at Ashley R. I'm more concerned that some prominent Dem will make a phone call in the 10th or 11th hour, and then West will tell us all to reelect Biden in exchange for the promise of future crumbs. And I think that's a concern. But I'm hoping, you know, that Cornell, he's laid down the gauntlet and he will, you know, stick to his position. You know, that's always a concern. But, you know, I think we should encourage Cornell to, I mean, another concern is that he may take a, you know, strategic vote or say state strategy and say, well, vote for Biden in the battleground states, which I think would undermine his whole rationale for running because it's basically not taken it seriously enough. Saying that, you know, we want your vote because we got a better program and we want to advance that program. And it will also irritate Greens in those battleground states who knock themselves off out to get him on the ballot. And then if he turned around and said, vote for the Democrat, he'd have a rebellion on his hands. So, you know, I hope that's not going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's not unreasonable to be concerned, but, you know, we could have that with any of our candidates. So I think he's taking his position and he's going to stick to it. Scout Trooper 164. The reason many states of the former USSR join NATO is because they see Russia as an existential threat, which you can't blame them for with what happened in Chechnya and Georgia. Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Baltic states in particular, I mean, they're small states on Russia's border. And, you know, Putin has been saying that a lot of these places are historic Russian lands. And, you know, they're afraid that, you know, they could do, Russia could do to them what it's trying to do to Ukraine right now. And what it did do in Chechnya, which was a brutal war. And in Georgia, where they, you know, have territories they supported that are, you know, separate from the Georgia government. Same thing in Moldova. They have Transnistria, which they occupied way back, I think, in 93. So, you know, those things make countries that, you know, or take Poland. You know, they were carved up between Hitler and Stalin in the years before, you know, Hitler invaded Russia. And, you know, the Poles remember that. So they, you know, they're concerned. So those are, you know, I think it's understandable why those countries want NATO to protect them. I think where what we want to urge the countries to do is move toward a trans-European or Euro-Atlantic security arrangement that everybody is agreeable to, you know, from Russia to the U.S. and everybody in between. What Gorbachev proposed as our common European home when the, at the time of German reunification. And unfortunately, you know, the U.S. got full of itself. It was the sole superpower and pushed NATO east rather than tried to negotiate this kind of mutual security agreement. And that was under the Clinton administration and such war criminals as Madeleine Albright, you know, who complained to Colin Powell, what's the use of this military if we can't use it? And said this to Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes, the death of 500,000 Iraqi children due to sanctions that were imposed by the Clinton administration were, quote, worth it. So, you know, that's why, you know, I understand why some people are skeptical of the U.S. Role in Ukraine because of just the horrific things we have done from Vietnam to Iraq and many places in between and still today. I mean, Biden was cozying up to Modi, who's occupying Kashmir and is, you know, got a ethno-nationalist Hindu or ethno-religious, you know, repressive government that is undermining Indian democracy, still selling arms to Saudi Arabia, still supporting Morocco, which is occupying the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, so-called Spanish Sahara. You know, you know, 9 times out of 10 what the U.S. is doing in foreign policy and military policy is supporting dictators and undermining, you know, Haiti. We're still supporting that dictator who got in there after the assassination of the previous guy. There's no parliament. He's ruling by fiat. And, you know, we're supporting him. I could go on and on. So, it's understandable why those East European countries want NATO's umbrella. And it's also understandable why a lot of people are skeptical when the U.S. is involved in anything. Vicky Gordon, it is said a lot of people will vote for Democrats for only the only reason to stop fascist Republicans. Yeah, that comes down to how do you beat the fascists? And the argument that Angela and I made in 2020, and Cornell didn't accept, we were on a podcast with him, we had it out, and he now does, is that the Democrats can't defeat, you know, the neoliberal corporate Democrats can't defeat the neo-fascist Republicans. And actually their policies fuel that neo-fascism that the Republicans are putting forward because neoliberal economic policies have increased inequality and insecurity among middle and working class people. And that opens the door for the scapegoating of immigrants and people of color and women and LGBTQ people by these neo-fascists. It's a politics of resentment and scapegoating. And then, you know, the Democrats are, you know, they talk about diversity, but when it comes to practice, it's really diversity in the sort of professional managerial classes, not diversifying opportunity for the working classes. And so that makes working class people and middle class people who are not in the upper middle class susceptible to this scapegoating and, you know, blaming immigrants and people of color, women and LGBTQ people for problems they didn't create. These are problems that come out of corporate capitalism and its operation in the United States. So the alternative to that is to present a positive, progressive program that, you know, points to a future where we have, you know, more equality, more economic security, and more social equality that enhances our lives rather than makes people feel threatened that somebody else is coming to take their spot. The great replacement theory that, you know, is explicit with people like Tucker Carlson and implicit in many of the things the Republicans say. And, you know, the Democrats don't know how to fight these fascists. I mean, Biden is still talking about bipartisanship with the party that tried to overthrow his election. That normalizes this authoritarian racist behavior by the Republicans. If you're going to beat them, you got to ridicule them. You got to defeat them politically. You really got to crush them politically and demoralize them and marginalize them. So these open racists who came out from under their rocks when Trump started, you know, got his platform, go back there. And, you know, they tend to be an older demographic. They're on the way out. And, you know, now's the time to, you know, really defeat them, to crush them. I remember Ralph Nader saying in 2020, the Democrats should crush the Republicans because Trump had nothing to offer. And unfortunately, you know, Biden, like Clinton before him and Obama before him, and you go all the way back to Carter, instead of running on progressive economic and social policies, ran to the middle. We see that now Biden's running to the right on his immigration policy, on that debt ceiling deal, and his continued, you know, talk about bipartisanship with a party that is trying to undermine democracy. So anyway, you know, hopefully Cornell will be able to articulate that alternative vision well, make it attractive. And what it could do is force, and this has happened before, it could force Biden to be better than he is and take a stronger position on these progressive policies. That's what Henry Wallace forced Truman to do in 1948. And Truman made a famous comeback to beat Dewey. And he did that by adopting much of Wallace's domestic program. So, you know, just being in the race, we can change the debate. And, you know, it's a long shot to win, but moving the debate, being in the debate is half the battle, because I think our positions are more popular than the neoliberal corporate Democrats and certainly the neo-fascist Republicans. So, you know, then you get back to the people who, you know, they're afraid of the Republicans, so they're going to vote for the Democrats no matter how bad they are. And that's where, you know, Cornell's got to say, I got a solution to this part of the problem. National popular vote using ranked choice voting for president. And if he's not in the race, nobody's going to bring it up. So we might as well get that discussion going now, because the Democrats, you know, they the only time they've lost to a Republican in the 21st century, when that Republican was first elected, is when the Republican lost the popular vote but got in there by the Electoral College. So you would think the Democrats would say, we got to get rid of the Electoral College. And there is a bill to have a national popular vote. It's got a handful of sponsors. Nobody's really pushing it. It's just the Democrats, you know, they're just letting it slide. They're sort of taking the system as given, even though the system is rigged against them. You know, the Senate, as I talked about earlier, now they got the Supreme Court, partisan gerrymandering, in this, particularly in the states controlled by Republican legislatures, is killing the Democrats. And they, you know, proportional representation makes gerrymandering nearly impossible because you have multi-member districts and each party gets its proportionate share of representation. These are real solutions that aren't even being discussed unless the Greens bring them up. So, you know, I'm hoping Cornell can be our voice on that, our tribune, and, you know, make it part of the national debate. It's a good time for that. We know from national opinion polls that the majority of people want a major third party. The majority of people are not affiliated with either the Democratic or Republican parties. They're looking for something else. And, you know, this is one line of attack where the Greens offer a real alternative to create an inclusive multi-party democracy with ranked choice voting and proportional representation. And I think, you know, it could be a real opportunity. You know, Cornell is mainly going to get in the media when he's attacked for being a spoiler. And his answer to that, if he can put those issues on the table and then, you know, make those reporters and commentators go back to Biden and say, well, what about it? Are you for ranked choice voting for president, national popular vote, and so forth? You know, that could be, I think there's an opportunity to make that a national issue. And unlike me, you know, little old retired Teamster from Syracuse, New York, I didn't have the celebrity Cornell does. So he's going to have more opportunities in the media, and hopefully he'll be able to take advantage of them. Steve Welser, early unification around a Cornell West campaign could give us a chance to get onto 51 ballots this time. Yeah, we got, I'll tell you, New York is going to be the hardest, as Richard Winger pointed out in a recent interview. We have to get 45,000 signatures in 42 days. And it's harder than any other state at this point. It's harder than any similar petition we can find anywhere in the world. The closest one is a third easier, and that's if you want to run as an independent for the state Duma, basically the national parliament in Russia from an oblast, which is like one of the states, they have to get 15,000 signatures in 45 days. The old New York standard was 15,000 in 42 days. And I actually met with the state senator, a group of us Greens, trying to get a fair ballot access bill introduced. And I pointed out to, you know, his staff that we just want to get back to the Putin standard. We've dealt with that in the past. We can deal with it now. You know, and they chuckled and said, you know, you got a point. So hopefully that was a good meeting. That was another thing that happened this week. And hopefully we will get a bill introduced. That the problem is, the session begins in January. It's got to pass early in the session. It's going to affect the 2024 election, which is going to be tough. So, early unification can help with ballot access, fundraising, because everybody, you know, there's not competing candidates. There's a lot that would help us, including ballot access. But New York's going to be tough. That's like the thing I'm working on right now, to get legislation introduced and then build support for it in the legislature and in the, you know, outside with civic and progressive groups. So hopefully we can get it done, but it's going to be touchy in New York. You got bills got to pass early if it's going to be operational in 2024. I guess we're coming up on the hour, and Anna behind the screen this week, Chris had a tornado roar through his town. He didn't have power or internet. So I want to, you know, wish you all a enjoyable holiday weekend. I urge you to, if you do anything, you know, speak to your member of Congress or write a letter to the editor about how the UN General Assembly's got to step up regarding the Zaporizhia plant, because, you know, Russia's kind of put a July 5th deadline on when stuff might start to happen there, which could be a disaster. And so with that, you know, I'll be here next week. I'm working on a number of guests and don't have anybody lined up next week, but you know, we'll continue talking these issues. And so with that, I'll see you next week.